Welcome to part five already of our 20th century controversy series. Tonight, I wanted to explore with you the controversy which began in the 20th century and perhaps has become even bigger in the 21st century, and that is the exemption of yeshiva students or some yeshiva students to the compulsory service in the IDF, which generally Israeli citizens are required to register for, and most serve in some capacity at the age of 18. For men, the service requirement has changed over the years, and now it's 32 months, but between like 32 months and 3 years, for women about 2 years. And since the founding of the State of Israel, there has been a population of students studying in yeshiva who have been exempted from serving in the army. And this exemption is categorized as Torah umenato, that if someone has Torah umenato, literally that Torah is their occupation, and that if someone who's studying full-time in yeshiva can get this exemption, that Torah is their occupation, and therefore they do not have to serve in the IDF for the mandatory period of time.
But it's strictly limited to Limud Torah?
So there are other exemptions in general.
What about people who teach Torah? What about rabbis?
So I believe
rabbis go to the army.
Yeah,
they're already past the age.
Are probably past the age anyway. But if so, I think it's for those registered as says studying in yeshiva. Mm-hmm. And we see nowadays, and this is why a controversy is always two sides to a story. Nowadays, if one looks at the entire Torah observant population in Israel, so we see many Torah observant Jews who serve in the army, who serve in elite units, and there are religious units for religious soldiers, and there are many who do not serve in the army. And that divide is somewhat correlated with, though we'll see from the sources, some of the positions might actually surprise you, that divide is somewhat correlated to the different religious groups' positions on Zionism and the State of Israel in general, though there are some nuances. So there are, among the national religious population, the Dati Lumi population, there is almost universal serving in the army. It's considered a big value. And in the Haredi population, very few yeshiva students of draftable age serve in the army.
And no women.
And, right, women is really a somewhat different question about the I guess, religious propriety of women serving in the army at all, when many in the Dati Lumi world, the national religious world, many women there, some do serve in combat units, many serve in Sherut Lumi. They do a form of national service, volunteering and things of the like that fulfill their army service requirement. And in the Haredi world, by and large, the men and women do not serve in the army, though there is a Haredi unit, and there has been an increase in Haredi men joining the army, though it is still small. And if one has been keeping up with the developments in Israel in the past couple of years, there has been vocal opposition to revising or reassessing what's become known as the status quo of exempting yeshiva students from the army. And I wanted to explore some of the reasons why there are some Torah observant groups who feel that serving the army is a great value. is something that's encouraged among the population, and why there are others who insist that those who are studying full-time in yeshiva should be exempt from service. So we'll take a look at some of the primary sources, and then later on we'll take a look at some of the written and recorded positions of authorities in the last century. So we'll begin. Source number one defines what different types of wars are classified as. So there are two general categories. There's what's called a milchemet mitzvah, an obligatory war, and a milchemet harishut, a war that's either optional, discretionary.
It's not and like a proprietary war? Like Rishut the Rabbim?
Meaning with the permission, right. There's a permission, but it's not... Rishut HaRabbim is like a public... Hmm. Well, right, Rishut is like a domain. Right. But either optional or discretionary war, and the obligation of the people and who's required to participate varies depending on the type of war. So in source one, the Rambam says... Ein ha-melech nilcham techila el milchemes mitzvah, that when a king ascends the throne and begins his military campaign, he should first fight those wars which are defined as a milchemes mitzvah. Ve'ezo hi milchemes mitzvah. What is a milchemes mitzvah? So zu milchemes shiva amamim. Milchemet mitzvah is a war that the Torah specifically commands. The Torah commands that we may get into the land of Israel. We dispossess the seven nations, and that's an explicit command in the Torah. Umilchemas Amalek, and the commandment to eradicate Amalek. The Ezra Yisrael miyat sar sheba aleichem. And to defend a defensive war, protecting Israel from its enemies. And it says va'achar kach, and after a king has done that, after he's gone to war with the seven nations, he's fought the milchemet Amalek, and has defended Israel from all of its enemies, then he can engage in a milchemet reshus, and that is, Himelchemet shel nilcham im shar ha'amim kedei laharchiv gvul Yisrael laharbos bigdulaso vishimo. And a milchemes reshus is to expand the borders of Israel. And it says, or to magnify its greatness and reputation. So the question becomes, what is the status of the wars that the modern state of Israel has fought, and by extension, the status of the security threats that Israel really faces on a constant basis.
I don't think there's any argument there.
About what the...
Yeah, I mean, it's Milchemet Mitzvah, except for 56. That was the only one that was perhaps debatable, but otherwise they were all started by our enemies.
They were all defensive.
Except for 56, yeah.
Right.
And who was the war 56 against?
Well, it was
Egypt,
it was,
right?
Well,
it was Sinai.
Yeah, it was the Suez Canal.
Yeah.
Britain,
Sinai,
France, campaign. And Israel against Egypt.
And the Egyptians were not one of the Shiva Amim. Right?
No, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Right. There. We got out of Egypt to then find the Shiva Amamim.
Yeah.
But even with it, I'm no expert in warfare, but I think if we look at the subsequent sources, at least the way the Torah defines it, and even just looking at military campaigns that Israel, or if you could look at any country, has fought, distinction between like a preemptive and defensive war is sometimes unclear. Like the Six-Day War, Israel was first to strike, but at the same time, there was already a blockade. There were already countries basically aiming for Israel at that point. So is that defensive, offensive?
Well, they were Rodef. I mean, they were pursuing.
Right. I'm not talking about the justification, but even for these purposes, sometimes it may not be so clear that. That really in the other direction, that clearly a defensive war is a milchemes mitzvah. But it could be, and we'll see in the subsequent sources, and we can discuss, it could be that even when perhaps Israel might fire the first shot, it may be considered defensive because of an existential threat, which I think was probably the case in the Six-Day War.
It's even more problematic, you know, because you have to judge what comes the outcome. Is the outcome of the war proof that a war was a certain type? For example, when Israel gained the Sinai, and they gained, you know, extended areas in Syria, they actually increased their size by double. So in other words, the outcome was you could say
territorial gain, right?
I mean, I don't sure Israel went in looking to gain territory, except for maybe it would protect itself more. But you know, the outcome maybe is proof that it may have been a milchemet reshut.
Right. That's interesting. That while initially it was done to protect itself, but then there were victories which...
Because it didn't give it back right away. It kept it for like 10, 15
right,
years.
Right, right. And so it sounded like...
In the Sinai. They kept the whole Sinai. Okay.
So it sounds... And I think if we look at the end of the Rambam in Source 1, so he says, Hilaharchi gvul Yisrael lulaharbos bigdulaso vishimo. That to expand the borders of Israel and to magnify...
In other words, you'd have to say that was the...
But who said
that was
it
the purpose?
Who said it was... Otherwise, they would have given it right back.
Right, so that's why these, and we'll see in some of the subsequent.
No, there were political considerations
right.
And military considerations.
Right, so that's increased its greatness, right? So, in other words,
didn't increase its reputation.
Well, I think.
It is reputation.
Or like awe in the world, and I think initially it did. The people viewed Israel as a power. Of course, then they had to apologize for it afterwards.
But then they viewed them as an occupying power. Right,
right. Right. So it can be somewhat unclear.
Well, you know, the first thing that Moshe Dayan was told after they, you know, he came back and said, "We're, you know, we've captured the Sinai." So the next day, he said, "When are you giving it back?"
Right, it right. Happen. So there were definitely some like dovish people in politics then. So in Source 3, Rashi defines a milchemes reshus. So Rashi says, "What's a milchemes reshus? Kol milchama kari reshus levad memleches Yoshua." Sorry, Milchamas Yoshua, Shahisa Lichvosh et Eretz Yisrael. That any war other than the war waged by Joshua is considered a Milchamas Rishus. So that would seem to imply that wars that the state of Israel fights nowadays are Milchamas Rishus. And we'll see, that could make a difference. This Gemara describes that can make a difference.
Why do you
regarding...
say that?
What does that mean?
Unless we had a Sanhedrin. What are you saying? Unless we had a Sanhedrin, you couldn't. Every war is Milchemet Rashut.
That seems to be Rashi's position, that a Milchemet Mitzvah.
We don't have a Sanhedrin.
Right. So it would sound like, according to Rashi, wars fought by the state of Israel would fit into the category of Milchemet Rashut. Doesn't mean that. This is actually why I wanted to. I was trying to define reshus more precisely. It's not necessarily optional, as you know. I have the option of eating Cheerios or Life cereal, and I'm just doing it for fun. Meaning, it's discretionary. There are factors at play, and there are important reasons to go. But it sounds like Rashi is defining milchemes mitzvah specifically as those wars which are commanded in the Torah. I mean, the Torah specifically says to go in and wipe out the seven nations, or to go to war against Amalek. So Rashi says those are the ones that are mitzuveh, that are commanded to us, and the rest are discretionary or optional.
The first wars were two of the countries were our ancient enemies, Babel and Syria. Lebanon, Syria was an occupier, and so was Babel. They both occupied. Iraq attacked Israel, and Syria attacked Israel. So we're fighting against, it has to be mitzvah, right? I mean, it couldn't be anything else, because that's we're fighting against those people, even though there was no court.
So according to Rashi's definition, I think he's limiting it to fighting those people or dispossessing those people in the land of Israel. The wars that specifically Yeshua was commanded to fight. The Rambam seems to have a broader definition.
A defensive war.
Right. The Rambam says a defensive war in addition to the war against the seven nations and Amalek.
Rabbi, it says there's no need to seek permission of the court to wage. So in other words, even if there's no court, you don't need permission. When you're attacked, you're considering that to be it's not a defense, it's not a reshut.
Right, according to the Rambam.
So Rashi doesn't preclude the fact that you can fight a war if you're attacked. And it's not necessarily a mechamat reshut.
Right, it's also a good question of what category it fits into. In general, if someone's attacking me, it's pikuach nefesh, I can defend my life. That may be a slightly different category than, or that may not change the status of the war. Meaning, for whatever purposes, the status of the war may matter halachically, but I think everyone agrees, just as a basic pikuach nefesh value, that if someone's attacking you, you can fight back. But the definition of what type of war it will be is going to be significant.
Okay.
I think we see in the following source, in source 4, the Gemara in Masechet Sota says, Amar Rava, Milchamos Yoshua Lekvosh Divar HaKolchova, the wars of that Yoshua fought to conquer the land of Israel, everyone agrees that those were obligatory, those were the Milchamos Mitzvah that were commanded in the Torah. Milchemes Beis David Lervacha, Divar HaKol Rishus, and the wars waged by David HaMelech, King David, for sake of territorial expansion, those were Divrei Rishus, and the Rambam says that, and I think it certainly applied from Rashi's comments. Ki Pligi, so where do they argue? L'miyute Obde Kachavim Delo Lese Alayhu. To reduce the idolaters so that they won't come against us. And we'll just keep that piece in mind. Reduce the idolaters so that they won't come against us. So we'll come back and take a look what exactly that means. Is that defensive or offensive?
In Sefer Malachim, is there mention of a Sanhedrin vote for David against the Plishtim?
Well, at that time they would consult like the Urim V'Tumim, and they would get permission. But
there was a Sanhedrin at the time, so
right. So I believe I imagine that David followed this rule that for Mechemes or Shos he got permission. Right. So there are right. So the wars of Yoshua, everyone agrees, are obligatory. The war is by King David to expand territories. Everyone agrees is discretionary, optional. Where do they argue? The miyute ovde kochavim de lo leisei alayhu, to reduce the idolaters so that they won't come upon us. Mar kari le mitzvah, umar kari rishus. So one sage, this is Rabbi Yehuda, calls this a mitzvah, this reducing the Gentiles so that they don't come. Umar karishus, and the chachamim, the sages, called it a rishus. Nafkamina laosek b'mitzvah shepater min ha-mitzvah. That one who is involved in a mitzvah, we have a concept that one who is involved in a mitzvah is exempt from another mitzvah. This has applications in the various areas in halacha. So the Gemara says that if it's a milchemes mitzvah, if waging war as reducing the idolaters so that they won't come and attack us, if that's a milchemes mitzvah, so then seemingly everyone should fight. There should be no exemptions. And if it's milchemes rishus, then those who are engaged in mitzvos would be exempt from fighting. And the Karen Ora, one of the commentaries, says,
wait a minute, if it's rishus and it's not a mitzvah, then why would you apply the rule of if you're doing a mitzvah, you're exempt from a mitzvah. If you're not characterizing the war as a mitzvah.
So that's the question. If it's not categorized as a mitzvah, so then
so
there
would...
Why
would you apply that rule?
You would not. You would only apply the rule
if it's
obligatory.
Mitzvah.
Right. If it's a milchemes mitzvah, you would say...
That if you're engaged in another mitzvah, then you're exempt from, right?
No, Rabbi Yehuda said that this is a type of war as a mitzvah, even though it's an elective war.
Right. Well, that's a good point. That the thing like osek mitzvah pater min a mitzvah is referring to the Milchemes Rishus.
Why? How could that be?
It is.
How could that be?
Because of the Gentiles were trying to protect themselves against the Gentiles.
So it sounds like a Milchemes Rishus still has a status of a mitzvah, meaning it's still a mitzvah to save lives or to expand Eretz Yisrael to all the territories that Hashem promised us, but it may not be a have the strength of something that will remove that will allow you to abandon another mitzvah. So the Karen Ora, maybe this will make it more clear. And the Karen Ora in Source 5 says, "Haka de milchemes mitzvah kol yotzin for a milchemes mitzvah." Everyone goes out. Afil talmidei chachamim tzrichin livatel milimudan. That even talmidei chachamim, people, and I think in this context, people who are learning Torah full time, have to stop their learning to go fight.
Well, that makes more sense than applying that principle to going out and fighting a milchemes rishus.
Why?
Because the principle is about interrupting one mitzvah for the sake of another mitzvah. Milchemes rishus. What's the distinction if you're going to call them both a milchemes?
Because they're both threats.
So right? I think a milchemes mitzvah. So I think certainly the way Rashi defines it, I think even according to the Rambam, is a milchemes mitzvah is a specific category that the Torah demands. The Torah says, "Go to war with the seven nations. Go to war with Amalek." I think even wars that are milchemes rishus, meaning if it wasn't a mitzvah, if it wasn't something that was condoned by the Torah, then we wouldn't go to war.
My take on this is if someone's attacking your country, your borders, and especially those it's our enemies, then of course you have a mitzvah. But you could have armies just parked at your border. Right? They're not invading you. They're just parked on your border. And that poses as much of a threat, even though it's not kilu a milchemet mitzvah. You still feel that is enough of a reason to consider it a justifiable war.
So you just said what we'll see in a moment.
Oh.
That example. You said, but yes. So I think the distinction between milchemes rishus and milchemes mitzvah is... I don't think it's in milchemes rishus isn't a mitzvah, meaning there are in case, meaning, and the practical difference would be, let's say there's, would people, let's say you aren't involved in another mitzvah, be required to join up in a milchemes rishus? It sounds like yes. It sounds like the only time someone would be exempt from joining in a milchemes rishus, which is a mitzvah for the various reasons you mentioned, that if someone is not involved in another mitzvah, then they'd be required to join up in a mechemes rishus. It would be for a mechemes mitzvah. Seemingly, we wouldn't apply the concept osek b'mitzvah pater min a mitzvah. We would say that a mechemes mitzvah takes precedence over even being involved in another mitzvah. Like
it's so counterintuitive.
Why?
Because the principle that one mitzvah exempts you from another mitzvah is only when you're comparing doing a mitzvah to doing a mitzvah. If it's a milchemes rishus, it's not a milchemes mitzvah.
No, I disagree. Because if you're trying to, for example, let's say in the Torah, I can't remember if it was in the Torah. I think it was in the Torah when the Midianite women. right? They started, you know,
prostituting
themselves almost to the Jewish men. We had to wipe them all out. The point of the matter is, it was, you know, was that a war? No, but it was a war because it threatened your survival. So you had almost a justification to go out. The mitzvah you're doing was actually going to be able to protect the people. I don't think we can judge so simply what is that, what kind of war
I'm
is.
I'm not proffering the judgment. The Rambam is. The Rambam, in his statement, says there's a distinction between a milchemes mitzvah and a milchemes.
Right. So, and this is based on this Gemara. So the Gemara is saying the distinction is for a milchemes rishus, and I think this is why I was trying to find rishus as like discretionary or as opposed to just totally optional. Is there a mitzvah in defense in settling Israel that can accomplish other purposes, but the war itself may not have that unique status as being one of the wars that the Torah commands.
Well, I don't even understand where the Rashi is coming. He limits it strictly to the wars that
Yehoshua, because Yehoshua
he doesn't even include Milchemes Amalek. He says only the wars of Yehoshua constitute a Milchemes Mitzvah. He doesn't say going to war against Amalek.
Right. That's interesting. We'll have to look further into it. Mm-hmm. I think what you're saying is true. What category does a milchemes rishus fall under?
I thought it was a category. I thought the Rambam was saying there are two categories.
Well, milchemes mitzvah, but I think specifically a mitzvah, a war that's outlined in the Torah that falls under certain categories, certain criteria that will. That will require a greater degree of participation. Although a Milchemes Rishus, it seems from this Gemara that a Milchemes Rishus is still considered a mitzvah, call it not a Milchemes mitzvah, but a mitzvah in the sense that unless you're involved in another mitzvah, you would be forced to fight.
Well, the Plishtim considered one of the seven nations?
Plishtim, I don't think so.
So it doesn't. It seems like I think what the Rashi is referring to is that the only war that Israel fought against seven enemies, it seems, was the one by Yehoshua.
The only war that was fought against them, in history.
Right.
I think so. I think that was the only real campaign to wipe out the seven nations.
Right.
It's fine. But there is a difference between where he's coming from.
I know,
right. He's more narrow.
Right, much more narrow.
He's narrowed the scope completely, you know, to that.
Yeah.
It's not just about Amalek. The defensive wars are also not
considered. Are also Milchemes Rishus. And I think that strengthens the point that it's still a mitzvah. It's still a mitzvah to defend oneself. Mm. But it's not the specific war, at least according to Rashi, the specific war that the Torah instructed. And it does seem, at least in my read from the Gemara, it seems like Rashi is perhaps an easier read. Because the Rambam is more expansive in what. And I think specifically on the point of like diminishing the idolaters and on that front. So in source 6, the Bach is, I put in the brackets in italics, so the context of this Bach, the commentary on the Torah. Because there's one place in the Rambam, in the introduction to Sefer HaMitzvot, where he says that without a Sanhedrin, there are no Milchemes Mitzvah. However, he says that you can be Mechal Shabbos in the case of a Milchemes Mitzvah. And the question is, why did the Rambam include that in the Mishneh Torah if it wasn't a mitzvah that's obligatory nowadays? And so the Bach says, the Afal Gav the Ein Yisrael Holchim in source 6, the Afal Gav the Ein Yisrael Holchim Ha'inna Lilachem Al Ha'yaros, Even though nowadays the Jews in the land of Israel aren't going to war for the lands, Hayin Yisrael Levadam, because the Israel is alone. There's the Jews don't have sovereignty in Israel. Aval Shchiyat Yisraelim Matay Misbar Nimtzayim Bein Anshei Hamilchama Shehochin Ala Yaros Vegam Elu Heim Beklal Zu Dein Sarich. And here's what he says: Bekein Melchemetz Mitzvah. And there are still cases, even though the Jews aren't in their land, there are still cases of Melchemes Mitzvah. What? Kigon? Shenishvu goyim v'Yisraelim muter leilech aleihem ima goyim afilu b'Shabbos, that if a town is, if Jews were taken captive, so it's permitted to go to battle against them, even on Shabbos, you're allowed to be Mechal Shabbos. Why? Says the Bach, to milchamas mitzvah hi lahatzil acheihem, because rescuing your brethren fits into the category of a milchamas mitzvah. So that sounds like you can make a case that at least with some of the wars that Israel has fought, that we discussed Entebbe before, we discussed even the Six-Day War, even. And that's a question about what about a war that's somewhat proactive, but is meant to, because I guess the way it works in the army is, you know, if you're not winning, you're losing. So, but certainly there have been cases where it's been straight out defensive wars, and certainly in those cases it sounds like those wars would have the status of a milchemes mitzvah, and therefore, seemingly, even those who are studying Torah would still have to fight.
You almost get the sense, the more you read among these passages, that, you know, it's even probably distasteful among the people to some extent. I'll give you an example. You know, up until 73, Israel was always attacked, except for that small incident in 56, which they call a campaign, they don't call it a milchama. But in 82, when they had the first Lebanon, then they had, in the 90s, the second Lebanon, it's the first time you ever had conscious objectors. I forget what they called them.
Conscientious objectors.
Yeah, the ones who refused. So you almost sense that there's a little bit of, the people can sense there's this obligatory war is not, or Rishud is not necessarily in keeping with almost the purity, for lack of a better word, of what Milchamim is all about. I mean, you almost, you know, because in other words, are you just dealing with a bloodthirsty leader who's trying to just usurp his power over the region, or really is it truly, and I think people sometimes can see through that.
That if a war isn't necessary, then there's less
even
enthusiasm.
If it, yeah, or is it worth going as a war?
Like, right, well, that's a question, even Rishus, meaning with Milchemes Rishus, right, the king has to seek the permission of the Sanhedrin, as opposed to Milchemes Mitzvah, if there are the Shiva Amamim there, so he decides he can go to war, he doesn't need to seek permission beforehand. So that certainly suggests that in Milchemes Rishus, there has to be a good reason to go. Yeah. So, I mean, it's certainly fair to, when any military campaign is undertaken, certainly to evaluate whether it's worthwhile. I mean, I hope people do, but certainly that should be evaluated. But when we look at the wars that Israel has fought, or even the state that Israel is in now, I think with Rambam and with Rashi and the Gemara, there are many types of wars that are a little bit unclear about whether they're rishus or mitzvah. According to Rashi, it would seem that really none of them are milchemes mitzvah. But even according to the Rambam, what would the status be of an offensive war as opposed to a defensive war? So it's somewhat unclear. So the next thing I want to discuss is, let's say it's a mitzvah rishus. Again, we saw some differences between them. My main difference is, as you saw, that even Torah scholars are required to go. So that would be a big difference. However, what about the category of Shevet Levi, of the tribe of Levi? So the tribe of Levi, the Rambam tells us, had a unique status. And he says in Source 7, V'lama lo zacha Levi benachlas Eretz Yisrael. Who is he? Why did the tribe of Levi not receive a portion in Eretz Yisrael and enjoy the spoils of war with the rest of the Jewish people? Right? Shevet Levi was supported by the people. They didn't have their own territory in Eretz Yisrael. Rambam says, "Bibnei shehuvda lavod Hashem, lavod es Hashem, lesharso lahoroso lahoros drachav hayisharim bishvata vatzadikim l'rabim." That because they were set aside to serve God and minister unto Him and to instruct people at large in His paths and righteous judgments. Because it says that the Levim should be the teachers, Yoru mishvatecha liYaakov v'saraska liYisrael. Teach the judgments to Jacob and your Torah to Israel. So the Shevet Levi was in this teaching role, in this studying role, and therefore they didn't have the material assets set aside for them. And the Rambam continues, Lefichach huvdalu midarchei ha'olam, they were separated from the ways of the world, lo orchin milkama Kishar Yisrael. Okay, so this is the main point. They don't have to go to war, and I think this is talking about a Milchemes Mitzvah. They don't have to, because it assumes that the rest of the Jewish people have to wage this particular war. So it seems that even in a Milchemes Mitzvah, we saw that, okay, Torah scholars have to go, but people in Shevet Levi, they seem to be a unique category. That even in a Milchemes Mitzvah, Shevet Levi doesn't have to go to war. Says they don't wage war, and they also don't get certain financial benefits, and they don't acquire for themselves through their physical power. He says, Ella, what do they do? Ella, Heim Chel Hashem, they're in the army of the warriors of Hashem. It says, Barich Hashem Chelo, God has blessed his legion. And it says that Hashem basically will provide for them, will take care of them. So this seems to indicate, okay, Torah scholars in a Milchemes Mitzvah have to go, but Shevet Levi, they're another category. So is anyone here a Levi?
My dad.
So it sounds like if you're genealogically a Levi, so your father would not have to join in a Milchemes Mitzvah, would not have to join war. But the Rambam says in the next halacha, he says, "Velo shevet Levi bilvad ella kol ish v'ish," and he continues, rather anyone who wants to dedicate himself to such a life of serving God, of removing himself from material pursuits, can be considered in the category of Shevet Levi, and the Rama says that, like, the burdens of the world will be removed from him. So the question is going to be, so can, what about nowadays? Can people decide they want to be like Shevet Levi?
Well, wait a minute. It's one thing to talk about it in biblical, from a biblical perspective, or from a period where Levim were actually providing a service in the Beis Hamikdash, etc. They had a purpose, and they said, your father was a Levi. What did he do for a living?
Yeah.
Was he a Levi for a living,
no,
or he was
no,
an
he
accountant for
yeah,
a living
yeah,
or something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So just by virtue of being a Levi, would you apply that exemption in a modern period because somebody's a Levi or a Kohen?
So it sounds like it's referring to Levim who are in the
service.
Right. But perhaps then you can make a case that people who are not genealogically Levim but now want to live a lifestyle that's truly in the service of Hashem, the Rambam seems to indicate that even non-Levim, perhaps even non-Jews, kol ish v'ish, can dedicate themselves to a life of service where they remove themselves from material pursuits.
Give you a better example of someone who took the mantle of Nechama under himself to fight.
Who did you say?
Matisyahu.
Matisyahu. He was a Kohen. So,
not the musician. But
that's Matisyahu. No, that's Matisyahu. No, so he's a perfect example of someone who was essentially part of the tribe of Levi, but he was a Kohen. You know, you would expect, you know, those two would not be able to fight. He fought.
Right. Pinchas was a tribe of Levi. Right. So there's, I think there are examples of people from Levi fighting, but it, but the Rambam seems to be saying that if someone wants to live in the lifestyle of a Levi, they can do so, and they could be exempt from even
Who says they can? Well, Rambam says only not the tribe of Levi, but anyone. But I think that's like becoming an ascetic.
We'll see. Because we'll see how some of the poskim define what this means. And I think according to one position, we'll see, it sounds like what you're saying, that it's a very rare category. Mm-hmm. Whereas another position, we'll see, it may not be so limited.
Here again, the Rambam is being much broader.
Right, right. And in source 8, the Rambam says that, this is based on a Gemara in Bava Basra, he says that Torah scholars are, this is a Gemara in Bava Basra, that Torah scholars are exempt from contributing to the city's protection, to hiring a security guard, to paying for weapons, for that, that, for financing that. Torah scholars are exempt because ein talmidei chachamim tzrichin shmira shebatorah shomartan. That talmidei chachamim, this is based on Aramaic, the Gemara says that talmidei chachamim don't need protection because their Torah protects. So it doesn't mean that they can stand in a war zone and be fine, but it sounds like if a town is hiring extra security, that however we're meant to understand the Gemara seems to be indicating that Talmidei Chachamim don't need that extra security. And the Gemara is hard to understand, but the Rambam is basically
exempt from the requirement of contributing to the protection of their brethren because they themselves are protected by their status.
It sounds like that could be. It's a difficult Gemara to understand, yeah. But that's where the Rambam is getting this, the Gemara in Bava Basra. Now, it could be, like, let's say someone's hiring a security guard, so maybe you could say the Talmud Chacham doesn't have to pay because he doesn't need that extra measure of security. And I'm not sure what that means. Maybe it's kind of a metaphysical thing, though the Gemara does bring that as like a legal concept, that Talmidei Chachamim, and also who's a Talmud Chacham, but the concept doesn't exist. So that may also impact at least a discussion about people studying in yeshiva. And this...
And by the way, this is talking about Talmidei Chachamim, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Talmidei Chachamim. Are all yeshiva students Talmidei Chachamim?
I would say no.
The way it used to be is that there was only a certain very, very small percent of exceptional Talmidim who were given that exemption.
Right. Well, when the exemption was given, the number of people studying altogether was much smaller. In Source 9, this is it's an Agada to Gemara, but it's very interesting. Like, and this could be certainly used for the side that supports the exemption. It says in Source 9, "Ma nenash Avram Avinu nishtabdu bonav l'mitzrayim masayim ve'eser shanim." For what reason was Avram Avinu punished that his children were enslaved in Egypt for 210 years? Bibnei she'asa angarya b'talmidei chachamim. He made it in order to fight the war with the five kings. He drafted talmidei chachamim. He drafted some of his disciples who were Torah scholars. Shenemar v'yarech as chanichav yelidei beso. He took his disciples and put them in the army. So the Gemara says, because of this, the Jews were enslaved in Egypt for 210 years. Mm-hmm. Again, what to make of this? I'm not sure, but it does. The Gemara does exist, and it sounds like Gemara.
Except there's a Rashi. Isn't there a Rashi that says all these men were one person, Eliezer?
Right.
Right. So they say, you know, they said the whole army was Eliezer, just one person. He defeated the five kings by himself. Anyway,
right.
It's one Russia.
Right.
The first Captain America.
So what? So I guess like many Agada to Gemara, I'm unclear exactly what it means, but it does indicate at least to some extent that those who are engrossed in Torah perhaps shouldn't be interrupted to join in a war effort.
Very interesting. That's the Yeshiva students all join for
Right, right, right. Yeah. So it's whether it's an exemption or requirement, these are all, that's why it's so multifaceted.
The students joined Bar Kokhba to.
Yeah, the rebellion.
Right, and in fact.
He supported.
No.
And in fact, the Torah indicates that it should be the righteous people who join in the war effort.
Yes.
So.
The Jew, yeah.
Right, so it's. Doesn't seem clear that this is like a mandate to refrain, but perhaps is an exemption that exists and we could say has some basis. At the same time, by many military efforts of Israel are in self-defense, and at least according to the way the Bach interprets the Rambam, are milchemes mitzvah, so that could be a reason to say on the other side that people, even those who are studying, should to join up and fight.
It also sounds like, you know, almost like a criticism on Avraham, you're not going to win your war by taking your chachamim. You're going to win the war by taking, you know, your soldiers. So leave the chachamim alone because they have just as much of a role to do, but it's not out of being a warrior, a soldier.
Right. I think that's a fair reading of
Heavenly
Sekhemar. That's what we
read. No, that was Rav Cook's basic point.
Also, you got the Rav Cook.
Except for Avraham did fight this war to rescue Lot. So
right.
It's not necessarily considered a...
Milchemes mitzvah. Right. So that's... Right, exactly. And I think it could definitely be the case that many wars, and maybe even the perpetual state that Israel is in, I don't know, it's hard to say. Is it existential by nature, even if someone is just like on guard duty, or is it reshus, because, you know, God forbid, but if there's no one attacking right then and there, so maybe it's only if it's responding to something. So it seems to be unclear the status exactly of many of the military campaigns or military efforts in Israel.
There's one difference, though, is that you can almost make a claim that Israel is at war all the time.
Right.
The state of Israel is at war all the time. So hence, you cannot relax the issue of milchama mitzvah. It's always milchama mitzvah is always there.
That it's perpetual, right? That it says, if we go back to, right, the Gemara says that if it's to sort of minimize the idolaters who are coming to attack you, right? So is that reshus or mitzvah? So, and that seems to be the case that Israel is dealing with. There is always a threat, but is a preemptive thing, is having a defense.
Well,
I think in the olden days it wasn't as I don't know to what extent there's an idea of military defense and intelligence and things like that. I think either you had an army and you were being attacked or you weren't.
Mm-hmm. And just because you're not fighting right now doesn't mean you're not at war.
Or does it? Doesn't mean you're.
Well, if there's no, they had treaties back in the time of the Talmud, the time of the Chumash too. They had treaties.
Right.
We talked about treaties all the time.
Right.
You know,
saying that there's a treaty. Right. So there's not.
Men had a treaty.
Right. So maybe.
So they don't have a treaty with half these countries. So how can you say they're not at war?
Right. It could be. I think there are some who consider it that, which is why there are those, particularly in the Dati Lumi community, who are very. So very staunch to believe that even yeshiva students should fight in the army, but that right that's I guess each individual effort or should I say even more broadly the act of being enrolled in the army, what status does that have? Are you enrolling because and now you're engaged fighting in a milchemes mitzvah? Then all these things I think are a little bit blurry. Because I think the question that would be evaluated is, and I'm not making the halachic determination, but let's say, is joining the army because there's a draft, is that signing up for a milchemes mitzvah, or is it a
David didn't have a voluntary army. They were all conscripted.
He was drafted, right, right.
So, I mean, that's just what the country does. I mean,
right.
In that case, it was the king.
Right, right. But could you say that maybe in that case, there could still be a cadre of people who either Shevet Levi or people who are studying all the time, who maybe if it's Milchemes Rishus, then would still have that exemption because they're Osek Mitzvah. I'm more saying this food for thought. I'm not sure of the answer.
In that time that you're talking
talking about, did people actually study all the time, or they actually went out and studied a little bit and made a living?
Well, apparently there was Shevet Levi. There were some, meaning Shevet Levi didn't have a portion of the land. They generally weren't involved in conventional work and were in the times of the temple and were involved in working in the temple and serving in the temple basically as their profession. But right, I don't think there were tens of thousands of people in Kola.
Right.
So that was, so it seems to be, at least what the Rambam is saying, it seems to be confined to Shevet Levi, though the caveat is, the Rambam says, anybody who wants can be like Shevet Levi. So what exactly does that mean? And I think that's what we're going to see shortly. So what about, now we get to the 20th century. We've talked about some of the issues, Milchemes Rishus versus Milchemes Mitzvah, people who might be exempt in the case of a Milchemes Rishus, and even those who might be exempt in the case of Milchemes Mitzvah. So that, how does this apply to the State of Israel? What do the contemporary authorities say? So when I was preparing for this...
Didn't we recently just have a Torah reading or laning about, you know, a bridegroom in his first year or somebody
who planted
a vineyard?
So those are all people who are exempt. Yes.
So there are other exemptions, even from Milchemes Mitzvah, right?
Built a house...
Built a house?
Planted an orchard, but did not reap its fruits.
A vineyard, yeah.
A vineyard did not reap. No orchard, I think it is. And then the second one is not been married for a year. Is it a vineyard? I thought it was an orchard.
Yeah. Where was that?
It's in...
In Dvar.
Mishpatim? No.
So it was before... It was before Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah.
It was in the final
planings,
right?
Dvar.
Yeah.
I think that would be in a Milchemes Rishus.
Yeah.
In Milchemes Mitzvah, it sounds like even those can be called up. Even Torah scholars, even...
Yeah.
Mm. So,
yeah.
You're right. That's referring...
Here you have this quote that even a bridegroom goes out from his...
in a Milchemes Mitzvah.
From his wedding, you know, from his chamber.
Right.
Right.
So
the bride from her chuppah.
Right, that's an Milchemes. Right.
You see, you almost have the idea, like, you know, you have Miluim, right? So in other words, a man is not, in this case, in Israel now, he's not exempt from the military until he's 55 or thereabouts that age. The point of the matter is that by keeping him in Miluim, you know, active duty, if you will, it almost validates the fact that it's a Milchemes Mitzvah, because in other words, you're always on duty. Whether or not you're actually fighting is another case.
But
you're
always
inscripted in the army. You're always inscripted in the army until you're actually released when you reach whatever that age that is.
Right. I mean, I'm not sure if that would be a Milchemes Mitzvah.
Why?
Either could be the definition of a Milchemes Rishus, that you're doing it just in case.
But it's the defense of the nation, which is the purpose.
Right, I'm not saying yes or no. I could hear both sides.
I can see that it meets the criteria of the Rambam. It's in defense of the nation.
Yeah.
Right. It might depend whether it's wartime.
Immediate threat. There's always an existential.
But there is an immediate threat.
Existential threat all the time.
Right. So that could be. I think this is why this is a contested issue. When I was preparing for this and doing some research, the first figure who is cited in an article, I recommend everyone reads it, and I can send it out after, on Yeshiva Men Serving in the Army, the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society. He quotes Rav Avram Yitzhak Kook. Now, who is Rav Kook? Rav Kook was basically the father of religious Zionism. He passed away in 1935 before the State of Israel was established. Mm-hmm. His son, Tzvi Yehuda Kook, became a prominent figure in Israel, and was a proponent of Shlemut Haaretz, of settling the land, of not ceding territory. And his two students in Merkaz Harav do serve in the army. So that's why I was surprised when I saw this description of Rav Kook's position.
Yeah,
It says Rav Kook felt strongly that students in the yeshiva should not be called to the front. For in their Bate Medrash, through learning Torah, they were assuring the spiritual welfare of the nation, and ultimately, we rely on our spiritual superiority to save us, not on our military might. Others have also strongly maintained the school of learning Torah is a more effective and more important shield for the Jewish community than military service. So, right, this surprised me, but Rav Kook evidently held that while the put great importance on establishing the state of Israel and even maintained that the government that would be established had the status of like a malchus of a kingdom, he maintained that there should be a population of students who are exempt. Again, how big of a population? What is the nature? What is the character of these people? But it was at least fascinating to me that Rav Kook did support in the idea of a military exemption.
Who appointed him as the first chief rabbi of Israel if he was before the establishment of the state?
So the British mandate had established a chief rabbinate. So it predated the establishment of the state. I think it was already after the Balfour Declaration. Mm-hmm. And he was the first chief rabbi of the rabbinate that was instituted by still under the British. Mm-hmm. However, of Shlomo Yosef Zevin, who is the author of Moedim La'alacha, in English, festivals, and Talmudit, the Talmudic encyclopedia, and an amazing Torah scholar. And he said powerfully, he quotes the pasuk from the Torah, will you send your brother to war and yourselves at home? So in his call to yeshiva students to take up arms equally with their secular brothers. He said, is your blood redder than theirs? He wants to know, yeshiva lives and families are being threatened the same as everyone else's, and he feels no person can excuse himself from the fray. He says, rabbinic dicta that in times of war, all go out to fight, even the bridegroom from his chamber and the bride from her chuppah. So Rav Zevin, who is actually a Lubavitcher chassid, but was very favorable to the idea of the state of Israel. So he speaks very, very strongly that no, even those in yeshiva should go and fight. Their lives are being threatened the same as everyone else's. Maybe you could, even if you want to say the Gemara in Bava Basra that Torah scholars don't need protection, well, maybe that's only extra protection. Here they're facing an existential threat. And he argued forcefully that even those who had been learning full time should still join the army.
Was he commenting specifically on wars in Israel, or was he commenting on? I mean, you have yeshiva exemptions in the United States too. Where did you?
I don't think there was this. No,
I think he was speaking in Israel.
Yeah,
at least so. However, Moshe Feinstein said, the translation of his tshuva, it says in source 11, it says, although the defense force is a significant matter, for Torah students, learning Torah is an even more significant matter, even more so than protecting the state, as stated explicitly in the first chapter of Bava Basra, that says that Talmid Chachamim don't need protection. And it seems that the state also recognizes this, and one who studies in a yeshiva gedola and involves himself in Torah is exempt from the obligation of the army. Certainly, then, one who desires to study Torah and become a giant in Torah in halachic instruction, Yirat Shemayim, should go to the yeshivot gedolot, and this will be a source of blessing for Klal Yisrael and a source of protection for all Israel. So, he seems to support the idea that, and this is, I think, going on the Shevet Levi idea, that a person who wants to commit himself to full-time Torah study and dedicate himself to that pursuit should be exempted from the army. And he says that also the state of Israel apparently recognizes this value if they give exemptions, and it could be more complicated than that.
I think it's abused. I mean, there's no stipulation of percentages of how many your men or what's the quota of.
Right, right.
Every single one of them. I mean, you can't say they're all Talmid Chacham. They're not
all Haredim.
Yeah, they're not all brilliant. Otherwise, you know, this doesn't work that way. So it's abused.
So it's very hard to sit there for hours and study. Not everyone has the.
Yeah, but my point
is, not all of them do.
Yeah, and
it's
an abuse thing.
Get out of the
So it sounds like from what Ramosha Feinstein said that it may not be limited to those who are extraordinary, but that someone who dedicates themselves, it sounds like he supports the idea that they can receive an exemption. However, in source 12, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who was Rosh Yeshiva at Gush Etzion, a Hezder Yeshiva, he argues forcefully in the other direction. He says, finally, even if we grant that the Rambam's statement about Shevet Levi does imply a categorical dispensation in purely halachic terms, it remains of little practical significance. We have yet to examine just to whom it applies. A Levi is defined genealogically. Those who are equated with him, however, literally or symbolically, are defined by spiritual qualities. And for these, the Rambam sets a very high standard indeed. He presents an idealized portrait of a selfish, atemporal, almost ethereal person, one whose spirit and intelligence have led him to divest himself of all worldly concerns.
An ascetic.
Yeah, it sounds like there are definitely characteristics of an ascetic, and who had devoted himself to stand before God, to serve him, to worship him, to know him. So he says, to how large of a segment of the Torah community, or any community, does this lofty typology apply? To 2%, 5%, this is just what we were saying. Can anyone confront the mirror and tell himself that he ought not to go to the army because he is Kodesh Kadashim, like Holy of Holies in the Rambam's terms? And he says, can anyone with even a torch of vanity or concern for Kavod contend this? So he says, lest I be misunderstood, that he wasn't trying to single out people who are learning yeshiva as specifically not possessing these qualities, but he's understanding the Rambam, and I think it's also a fair reading that he's speaking about a category of people who are just extraordinary, not just anyone. Yes.
But the one problem you haven't addressed, and I'm not sure I haven't looked ahead, but is the issue that in Israel you have men and women serving. And so the problem with a lot of these guys who aren't married is that, you know, they're on base or whatever with women in their midst, and it's not right for them to
not
be
in
that
the
way.
Religious unit.
There's very few of them.
So that is in the current.
So a lot of them, by the way, claim that they cannot go in for that reason alone.
So in the current debate about joining the army, that's actually a point that I think is brought up just as much, if not more, than some of these ideas of. Not necessarily that just that the Torah protects and these are like Shevet Levi, even though I have heard that argument being made, but also that there are Haredim who feel, and even some of the religious Zionists who feel, that the environment and things that will be encountered in the army will be threatening to a person's religiosity. So that is an argument that that has been made. I've heard Aaron Feldman from the University of Baltimore make that, but I think it's pretty. That's a pretty common argument of those who support the exemption.
Right. But what's problematic is that, you know, it's where you have half the religious people going to the army, the other one don't. It's almost like, you know, they may be, someone's got to be wrong about it. I don't think it's totally murky all the time. I think, you know, the fact that every national religious party, you know, Kippur, Shrugag, all go, it says that there's something right about what they're doing. And not necessarily, because I'm sure they're looked on negatively by the Turei Karta, the Haredi, you know, the heavy black ones who don't go at all. It's, you know, they may be reading this wrong.
It could be. It could be. Or it could be some are meant to
it's just like
not
voting.
Join, some are meant to join. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. This is the jury, I think, is out on this one. But on the back page, I know we're running short on time. But I feel like I had to include these two stories. Now, just these stories are powerful. One, because you see the Avos Yisrael of these two Gedolei Yisrael, Rabbi Yisrael Zev Gustman and Shlomo Zalman Orbach. But also, these were both figures who were associated with the Haredi community in Israel. Like going back to our first year, these were more fit in the category of the non-Zionist ideology. But you see how, even though I imagine they supported the idea of yeshiva students, specifically Haredim, being exempt from the army, you see how they regarded those who served in the army. So the second figure, Shlomo Zalman Orbach, so he was asked, you know, now it's a popular thing. They go up to Meiron, to Lag BaOmer, to go to Uman for Rabbi Nachman's Yahrzeit. So a student asked him, what does the Rosh Yeshiva think about visiting Kivrei Tzadikim, of going to graves to righteous people to daven? Should I do that? I'll have to take a day off. I won't be in yeshiva. should I go up to the north to go to pray at the graves of tzaddikim? So Rav Orbach answered. He says better to stay in yeshiva and study Torah. So he felt altogether better to that studying Torah, and I guess consistent with just the value in general, that studying Torah superseded even praying at graves of tzaddikim, which could be another shir, but it's considered to have some religious value. But he said better to stay at yeshiva. But and the student says, isn't there a time that I could go visit the graves of tzaddikim? And he said, doesn't Rav Orbach go to pray at Kivrei Tzaddikim sometimes? So it says, Rav Orbach answered, in order to pray at the graves of tzaddikim, one doesn't have to travel up to the Galil. Whenever I feel the need to pray at the graves of tzaddikim, I go to Har Herzl. It's the National Cemetery for Fallen IDF Soldiers. It's the graves of the soldiers who fell, Al Kiddush Hashem, for the sanctification of God.
That's all fine and good, but it doesn't help the ones who've lost a son. And while the other one, they look around and say, the guys in the black hats don't have to go to the army.
So I do see that. And I think that's why it's a very, very sensitive issue. But I think this does bring out the fact that even though we see in the media, and I think unfortunately it's true, that there are those who protest the draft, but then do it in ways that cause a massive Chil Hashem and are really terrible and disrespectful of soldiers. But we see, Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach, he was of the community that in general did use the exemption, but he said that when he felt the need to pray at Kivrei Tzaddikim, he would pray at the graves of those who died al Kiddush Hashem. That he didn't go up north to the Rambam's grave, to Shimon Bar Yochai. He'd go here in Jerusalem. He said, you don't have to travel far. Go to the graves of those who died al Kiddush Hashem, and that accomplishes the religious value of praying at Kivrei Tzaddikim. And this next story, so Rav Yisrael Zev Gustman, he was from Lithuania originally. He went through the Holocaust, lost his family. When he was 21 or 22, he was appointed to the Beis Din of Vilna with Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, who is known as the Gadol Hador. So he was a brilliant person. He sat on the Beis Din with Rav Chaim Ozer when he was like 21 years old. He lost his family in the Holocaust. And he was, he had yeshiva in Israel, and his published shiurim, he had many students. And in the following story, there is a professor, Alman, who had lost a son. His son was in the army. He had lost his son. Actually, just Rav Gustman Shurim was known. They were attended by a wide variety of people. So his professor Professor Alman had been attending the Shurim. So he came and he visited him after his Rav Gustman visited Professor Alman after his son had died, and as he started to speak in Yiddish, then spoke in Hebrew, so that all of the crowd would hear. And he said that he had a son, Meir, who was a beautiful child. He was taken from his arms and killed. He said that after his son was killed, he took off his shoes. He bartered his son's shoes for food. But was never able to eat the food. He gave it to others. And he said, my son, Meir, he's a kadosh. He is holy. And he said, he's holy, and all the 6 million who perished are kadoshim. And he says that in Gan Eden, there's a minyan comprised of all the people who died al Kiddush Hashem. And he said, my son, Meir, is in that minyan, and your son Shlomo was just welcomed into the minyan. And he said, while my son Meir is in the minyan, your son Shlomo is now the shliach tzibor of that minyan. Because while the other kedoshim were killed because they were Jewish, your son, who was killed in the line of duty, died protecting and defending the Jewish people. So he's the leader of that minion of people who died al kiddush Hashem. And Rav Gustman sat down and sat with Professor Aumann, and Professor Aumann said that he thought he would never be comforted, but Rav Gustman's words comforted him. So I think this story gives us a sense of how much whatever we or the Rebbeim who we follow or whatever our perspective is on the particular issue of exemptions for those who are learning Torah full time, I think this should give us a sense of appreciation and indebtedness to those who do serve in the army, who have unfortunately fallen in the line of duty, and also to see the great value that is placed on learning Torah. And personally, I think it's unfortunate that a lot of times this issue isn't really discussed in a calm way, in a way that really listens. A lot of times it's people shouting past each other. I think it's unfortunate because I think it's important to understand both sides. I think it's important for people who do receive the exemptions to understand that there are families that have people in their family who are either currently risking their lives or who are given their lives, and that's no small thing, and I think it's something that should perhaps be expressed more. But also those who are learning Torah and who want the exemption, I think they really believe that their Torah is protecting the Jewish people, and the sources to indicate that. And I appreciate the opportunity to discuss this. All b'shalom. I hope it's discussed b'shalom more. Completely. And hopefully the army should be successful, and the Torah Shari should help, and there shouldn't be a need for an army and for this debate much longer.
I have one more thing, if you don't mind.